joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. To paraphrase one of my guests this hour, 2009 is a very significant year in the search for signs of life outside the Earth. When Jill Tarter, director of the Center for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI, accepted the prestigious TED Award earlier this year, she noted, "It's the 400th anniversary of Galileo's first use of the telescope, the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin, and the 50th anniversary of SETI as a science." Jill Tarter joins me from a studio in Berkeley, California, along with John Jenkins, analysis lead for the Kepler Project. Joining me here in the studio is Alan Boss, research scientist for the Carnegie Institution of Washington and author of a new book titled The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. Of course, this is a very exciting subject, and I do invite your comments, questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And you can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Diane.
And Jill, if I could start with you, what does SETI actually do?
Well, SETI is an acronym that stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and we use large radio telescopes and optical telescopes to look at the universe and see if we can see evidence of someone else's technology, some advanced technology that's modifying in its environment in a way that we can sense over the vast distances between the stars.
Now, I gather you make no presumptions.
It's a question that we're asking. Are we alone? And we really do not know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to do an experiment rather than ask the priests and the philosophers, which is what we did for millennia.
And John, you call your work the ultimate staring contest. What do you mean? And tell us about the Kepler mission.
Well, the Kepler mission consists of a telescope in an Earth-trailing orbit. And it looks and stares continuously at a field of view that is as large as two Big Dippers. And we monitor the brightnesses of 150,000 stars simultaneously and continuously for the next 3.5 years plus. And we're looking for instances when the stars wink at us, when a small planet crosses in front of its star, blocking out a small smidgen of light. And we watch to see that repeat. And that's how we find planets. But Kepler's job is to simply sit there and stare at this one field of view, and I'm certainly glad that I don't have that job. My job's much more fun. I get to process and analyze the data and see the signatures of the planets in the data and forward that on to the science team for follow-up.
So as you've been analyzing all these data, have you had any, you know, wondrous moments of recognition?
Well, perhaps one of the biggest days in Kepler's life so far was when we received the first 10 days of science-like data towards the end of commissioning. And I came into the office early that morning to look through the data, and it was our first glimpse at what the data would look like and the first idea of how well Kepler would actually function. And there were three known transiting planets in our field of view that we had put on our target list. They had been discovered earlier by ground-based astronomers. One of these is HAT-P7b. And to our astonishment, we saw something more than just the transits of this planet crossing in front of its star every 2.2 days. We actually saw the signature of its atmosphere. And we saw the signature of the planet actually not crossing in front of its star, which is what you can see from the ground. We saw it disappear behind the star because we could see light from the planet itself. And this drop in brightness due to the planet crossing behind the star is the same size as the signature of an Earth crossing in front of a sun-like star. So in one fell swoop, we demonstrated that we can see transits of planets in front of stars, and we have the precision necessary and sufficient to find Earth-like planets around sun-like stars.
John Jenkins, he's principal investigator for the SETI Institute at NASA's Ames Research Center. Jill Tarter is director of the Center for SETI Research. And turning to you now, Alan Boss, talk about how one goes about hunting for planets.
Well, the basic techniques, besides the one that Kepler uses, the first ones that found planets are based on something that we all learned in elementary school, which is not quite right, which is we're told that the planets orbit around the sun. In reality, the planet and the sun both orbit around the center of mass of the sun-planet system. And so that's basically like the balance point on a teeter-totter. So if you consider a very simple system like the sun and Jupiter, Jupiter being 1,000 times less massive than the sun, that means that the sun sits on a fulcrum which is only 1,000 times closer to the center than Jupiter is. So when Jupiter goes around a big circle, the sun goes around a very tiny circle every 12 years, and the size of that circle is roughly the size of the sun's diameter. And it moves around that circle with a speed of about 30 miles per hour. So the very first Jupiters that were found by measuring the change in velocity of that sun moving around the center of a mass as it orbited around periodically. Because 30 miles per hour, of course, is a pretty easy speed to detect with a radar detector gun, and it's using the Doppler technique. So that's been the most proficient way of finding planets so far.
But how do we know there's just one sun?
Well, there are many stars that have planets at this point.
Right.
The real question is how many planets do they have? And so you typically find one planet orbiting around the star first, then you continue following the sun's wobble, and
if the wobble
does some more strange things, that means there must be other planets in the system. So you can then find out that there may be several planets there. In fact, the astronomers have found several stars that have at least five planets around them, which is amazing considering that our solar system only has eight planets right now. They all have almost as many planets as we do.
Now, tell me about what is called a super Earth. I don't understand that.
So the first planets that were found by this Doppler technique were rather large gas giant planets with masses similar to that of Jupiter and Saturn, which are about between 100 and 300 times the mass of Earth. But recently, the Doppler folks have been able to improve their precision and get to lower and lower mass planets, now in the range of 5, 10, 15 times the mass of the Earth. We call these super Earths. Some of them are quite far out, so we think they're quite cold. They're probably analogous to Uranus and Neptune, the ice giants in our solar system. But a number of them are also quite close to their stars, or hot and warm super-Earths, and we believe those objects are actually very much like the terrestrial planets in our solar system. They're very much like Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. They're just a little bit overweight.
Alan Boss, he's research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington. His new book is titled The Crowded Universe. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Jill Tarter, tell us about the significance of this amino acid we've been reading about that was recently found on a comet.
Well, that amino acid was glycine, and it is one of the building blocks of life as we know it. We expect it may, in fact, be a building block for life elsewhere in the universe. We have been searching for evidence that it is abundant in the interstellar medium and therefore likely to have seeded any other planets around other stars. And this result that has just been announced from the Stardust mission confirms the initial claim that glycine had actually been found in the dust grains collected from Comet Vilt 2. The tricky part was to decide whether or not the glycine that was detected actually came from human contamination or whether it was intrinsic to the comet. And by studying the abundance, the relative abundance of two isotopes of carbon, carbon with different numbers of neutrons in its in their nucleus, we were able to show, or the researchers were able to show, that indeed the signature is that of the interstellar medium as opposed to the ratio that life imparts to organics. And so we now know that glycine is indeed abundant out there in the universe, and it's after water. I think this is the next biggest really great thing to foster the at least appearance that the universe may be biofriendly.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned water, Jill, because we've had a number of emails asking about why we are so intent on following traces of water on in other areas of the biosphere, if in fact maybe water is not necessary to other living planets.
That, in fact, is a possibility. Certainly, life as we know it
right.
on this planet
right.
requires water.
Exactly.
We had a symposium earlier this week discussing weird life, discussing life that could exist potentially using some other biosolvent that isn't water, using other kinds of metabolic schemes different than life as we know it uses. And certainly it's a possibility. But when you're trying to look for something and you have to build specific instruments to do a very hard job, it's a good idea to start with what you know.
Yeah, exactly. Jill Tarter, she's director of the Center for SETI Research. We'll take just a short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Joining us now from his office at the University of California at Berkeley is Eric Korpela. He's the SETI At Home Research Project scientist and research astronomer. Good morning to you, Eric. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane.
Tell us about SETI At Home.
Well, SETI at Home is a SETI project. We collect data at the world's largest radio telescope in Arecibo, Puerto Rico. And we don't have the capability to do all the analysis on that we would like to do on this data with our own computers. So the way SETI at Home works is if you want to help us analyze data, you can download a piece of our software, which will every few days contact our servers, grab a piece of our data, download it, analyze it on your home machine, and return any results that it finds back up to our servers.
How many members have you got so far?
Right now, last time I looked, there were about 6.2 million people who had downloaded and run the software. Now, the project's been going on for 10 years. We just celebrated our 10th anniversary back in May. So we don't have that many people running the software continually. But at any given time, there are 180,000 people running SETI at Home. And each of those people, on average, has a couple of computers working, so maybe 350,000 computers.
But, Eric, wouldn't you think that given that this is the 10th anniversary and that you've had under 6 million people participating, wouldn't you think if E.T. were out there, we'd have heard by now?
That's a good question. We, SETI at Home has advanced. Our original hardware system at the telescope was using one receiver that was not the best receiver available at the time. Since then, our ability to detect signals has advanced by about a factor of 10, so we can see things that are typically 10 times farther away. We also collect about 14 times as much data at any given time, so our capability has increased. So maybe back in the early days of SETI at Home, we weren't able to look as at stars as far away as we are now. And it takes a while to cover every part of the sky Arecibo can see. So we haven't yet covered the sky at our full sensitivity.
So you're still inviting participants to join you?
Yes, and we have plans to upgrade our capability even further as new instruments come online. And hopefully, if ET's out there, eventually either our telescope or one of Jill's telescopes will find him.
Eric Korpela, he is the SETI at Home project scientist and research astronomer. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
All right. And turning to you, Jill, we've had a tweet, two words, the Fermi paradox. I assume your guest will address this conundrum. If the odds are so in favor, where are the ETs, Jill?
Well, the Fermi paradox refers to a statement by Enrico Fermi at lunch at Los Alamos many years ago, and he said, "Where is everyone?" And what he meant there was that if another technology had come into existence at any place and at any time in the galaxy, he postulated that their technological advance would be so rapid that they would acquire the ability for interstellar travel almost immediately on a cosmic timescale, and that they would colonize the galaxy in a time that's very short compared to the lifetime of the galaxy. But we don't see them, and he therefore concluded that this was a paradox, and that meant that there could never have been at any other time or place in the galaxy another technological civilization, meaning that we'd have to be the first. And the problem, from my point of view, with that statement is it's claimed to be a robust paradox because it's based on the claim that we haven't seen them. But on the other hand, we've hardly begun to look. We've so poorly explored our own solar system, let alone the solar systems of other stars that John Jenkins is going to find, that we can't exclude the fact that they are here. There could be lots of nanoprobes and other small craft within our solar system. They could even be grinding up an asteroid or two every other year for their raw materials out there. And we just wouldn't know it. So we can't say with any confidence that we haven't seen them. So the paradox is not strong.
So even though SETI has been searching for signs of extraterrestrial life for half a century, in our lifetime measurement, you are not discouraged.
Not at all. Let me give you an analogy, which is actually fairly accurate numerically. Suppose the question was not, is there life, any intelligent life anywhere else in the galaxy, but are there any fish in the ocean? And the experiment that you did to try and answer that question was to take a single 8-ounce glass and dip it in the ocean and look at what you found in that glass. Now, it's an experiment that could work to find fish because the smallest fish is a bit over a millimeter in size. Your eye could see that. And although you wouldn't catch big tuna in your small glass, there are a range of fish sizes that you could capture in that glass. But if you did that experiment, dipping one glass of water out of the ocean and examining it, and didn't find a fish, I don't think that you'd conclude there were no fish in the ocean. Mm. You'd probably conclude that you hadn't sampled enough. And what we have done in 50 years, as fantastic as it is in terms of the technologies we've been able to employ, is absolutely equivalent to searching the oceans by dipping one glass.
Alan,
it's not a lot.
Alan Boss, do you believe there is extraterrestrial life in the universe?
I think it's inevitable because while we're waiting for Kepler to tell us exactly what the frequency of Earth-like planets is, we already know from the ground-based Doppler surveys, these detections of the hot and warm super-Earths, which seem to occur at a frequency of something like 30% of all sun-like stars, which is immense. We think Earth-like planets should be even more common than that. And so the feeling is that Kepler is going to tell us that, yeah, the frequency of Earths is something like close to one, somewhere between maybe 10% and 100% of sun-like stars have Earth-like planets. And given that, and given the fact that we know that comets come in and hit planets and have basically their giant cans of prebiotic soup because they have amino acids like glycine and other chemicals that are useful for starting life, you start dumping cans of soup into a watery planet, which is right in the habitable zone where liquid water exists on the surface, and let it sit there and stew for a couple billion years. I don't see how you can stop life from evolving. It may not all be intelligent life, but there could be something crawling around on that planet.
All right. And John, what happens next if or when Kepler discovers a planet that looks capable of sustaining life?
Well, that's the next chapter in the search for life on other planets. Kepler is a census taker. We're going to look out into the cosmos, into our solar neighborhood, and determine the frequency of Earth-like planets. But most of the planets we find are going to be orbiting stars that are 1,000 or more light years away. And that's too far for us to follow up and actually seek signatures of activity of biological entities, or even to learn much about the atmospheres or whether these planets have oceans. That'll be for follow-on missions such as Terrestrial Planet Finder. And the importance of Kepler is that it will help scope and the size of these instruments. If you're going to build an interferometer or a coronagraph that's capable of peering through the glare of a host star to see a tiny pale blue dot, and then to do spectroscopy to understand whether there's water and carbon dioxide and methane or ozone in the atmospheres of these planets, the size of your instrument depends a great deal on the distance to the planet. So Kepler will answer that question. How far do you have to peer into the cosmos in order to find good targets for these follow-on missions?
And
so that's really the next step.
And what about other countries? What are they doing to try to move this process on, John?
Well, there is a mission that was launched in 2007 that was called Corot by ESA and by CNES, which is the French space agency, and they've been looking for evidence of transiting planets, much like Kepler. They have found some evidence for at least one super Earth. But it's, in some sense, a precursor mission to Kepler. It's a smaller telescope, and we've learned a lot about the behavior of stars and what that might mean for Kepler's prospects for finding planets from Corot. But in terms of finding life on other planets, the Europeans are pursuing an idea called Darwin that is much like follow-on missions to TPF even. And the thought is that these missions are going to require so much in terms of resources that eventually NASA and ESA are going to have to band together to actually execute these very ambitious missions to characterize the atmospheres of these other planets and perhaps to detect signatures of life on them.
Alan, you want to add to that?
I was just going to back up what John just said, which is that there have been active plans between the people at NASA, at Jet Propulsion Laboratory primarily, who are planning for the terrestrial planet finders, who are working vigorously with their European colleagues from the European Space Agency, and they both agreed on a design for an infrared interferometer called the Emma Darwin Array, which is nice to get in Charles Darwin's wife as the name of the array. They've basically both agreed that that is the optimal design for such a space telescope that would be capable of detecting and characterizing the atmospheres of nearby Earths. So we know how to do it. We just basically need to have the money to do it.
And there
good planets are hard to find.
Yeah. I would think, however, that given the current economic situation, Jill, that there may be some reluctance in putting more money into these kinds of projects.
Well, I think that this is a question that excites the average taxpayer in any country, and of all projects that might be funded, I think this is one that resonates quite well, trying to understand our place in the cosmos. Are we unique, or are we part of a much larger population of life and some of it intelligent out there? So, yes, there are many pressing needs for funds here on Earth, but the most human quality that we possess is our curiosity, and I think that it is worthwhile feeding that curiosity by trying to answer the big questions that have been around as long as humans have been.
At 26 and before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Jill, tell us what we're listening to.
This is the sounds of the cosmos. This is actually the sounds of ionized particles that are blown off the sun and enter the Earth's magnetic fields and get funneled down towards the pole. And when they interact with the atmosphere, we see these beautiful, in our case, northern lights, the aurora. And this is actually the sounds of the aurora detected by some appropriate instrumentation.
It's very interesting that these are created as rhythmic entertainment from Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead. I was fascinated to listen to those, Alan.
It is amazing. It's not quite like the usual Grateful Dead long rambling piece, but it's equally fascinating.
But actually, Alan, what's happened in the recent Grateful Dead 23 Cities tour is that he kicked off the drum solo in each city with a different one of these cosmic sounds and then elaborated on it from the natural rhythm.
Huh. Very interesting. All right, we're going to open the phones now. We've got many, many callers. Let's go first to Dimitri in St. Louis, Missouri. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, sir.
I have a question for your panel.
Sure.
I would like to ask the panel that, or make this statement briefly, Andromeda Galaxy, which we can almost or usually see with the naked eye if we know where to look. And it would take generations of people to be born and die before we could reach it. Can you tell me or justify information about planets in which it would take thousands of years to reach as being something that we need to know? And I consider it useless information.
All right. Thanks for calling. Jill.
Oh, well, I'm surprised that the caller is not a little more curious about whether or not there is life elsewhere. Let me suggest to him that there might be some very viable information for him, in the sense that if we were able to detect a distant technology and we're actually trying mostly to look for life elsewhere in our own galaxy rather than Andromeda Galaxy, which is so far away, the only way that that detection can take place is if technology persists for a very long time, that is, long on a cosmic timescale rather than a human timescale.
Jill Tarter, she is director of the Center for SETI Research. And we'll take a short break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds whose mission is to maximize the power of philanthropy to strengthen communities, at fjc.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose financial reform project provides analysis to guide the debate over financial modernization, at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new movie Big Fan was written and directed by Robert Siegel, who also wrote the screenplay for The Wrestler and used to edit The Onion. Big Fan stars comic Patton Oswalt in a dramatic role as an obsessed New York Giants fan who's a regular caller on his favorite sports talk radio show. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Oswalt and Siegel. Join us.
And welcome back. We're talking about the search for extraterrestrial life. Here in the studio is Alan Boss. He's a research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington. His new book is titled The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. Jill Tarter is on the line with us from Berkeley. She's director of the Center for SETI Research, and John Jenkins is principal investigator for the SETI Institute at NASA Ames Research Center. We've got lots of email, lots of callers. Here's an email from Joseph, who said, I read this week in USA Today that in our attempts to listen for some kind of radio signals from space for the last 30 or 40 years, we have never heard anything except for one brief episode back in the 70s that was heard briefly, then lost, and never heard again. If so, what was that episode like, Jill?
Well, that episode is known as the WOW signal. Back in the day, right, the Ohio State University Radio Observatory was not able to analyze the signals they detected in real time. They wrote out signals to a paper recording device, And a researcher came around every week to pick it up. And when he saw this signal, which was stronger than any they'd seen in the past, he wrote "wow" in the margin. Now, the problem was it was something, but it was gone by the time the researcher found it. And that is something ever since that we've tried to get away from in SETI. We've tried to have the ability to do our signal processing is in real time so that when a signal's there, we can follow up on it and figure out whether it might be coming from someone else's technology or whether it's a product of our own, which is almost always the case.
Here's an email from Keith in Indianapolis who says, later this month, an observatory in Australia is going to send a batch of messages to an exoplanet called Gliese. Can you tell us about that, Alan?
I don't know what the new telescope will be sending as a message, but the a Russian telescope has already done that a year or two ago. Alexander Zaitsev and his colleagues at the Evpatoria telescope in Ukraine sent a message to Gliese 581, which is a relatively nearby star which has a super-Earth in orbit around it, and it's about 20 light-years away. So they sent a message there which contains some music and some images of what life is like on Earth, and basically we have to wait another 40 years for anyone on Gliese 581 to hear our message and send us a message back. So stay tuned. 40 more years to go.
John, what do you think about that? Does SETI have anything to do with what Australia is up to?
No.
No.
No. Jill is shaking her head at John because this is a somewhat potentially controversial situation. There are individuals on the planet who feel that we should not be transmitting deliberately and drawing attention to the Earth because there may be extraterrestrial technologies out there that do not have our best interest at heart. The problem there, of course, is if that's the case, there's nothing we can do about it. If they can get here, they're going to do so. So what's needed and what we haven't been able to do is to have a global conversation about whether we should be speaking for Earth, and if we decide to do so, who should speak for Earth and what should we say?
Well,
and
here's...
I'm excited now that maybe the social networking technologies that are catching up with us and enveloping us may give us the tool to have that global conversation.
So what you're saying is that the Australian effort is controversial because it might really reach somebody who's out there.
There are people who claim that. Yes, there are people who get excited about this.
How do you feel about it?
I think that a single transmission has very little probability of being detected. I think if you're serious about transmitting, we need to do it for a very long time in order to have much probability of detection. And long is tens of thousands of years. And we're just not grown up enough to take on many 10,000-year projects. We don't do very well at 2- and 5-year plans.
All right. Let's go to a caller in Narrowsburg, New York. Good morning, Emil. You're on the air.
Oh, hi there, Diane. Love your show. I guess I got two quick kind of question comments. First, why is it that we are so positive that aliens would use the same kind of technologies that we could detect when we keep finding out how harmful so much of our technologies are, like microwaves and cell phones? And it's kind of interesting. I feel like that we are visited by some sort of other life, but I wonder why everyone thinks that there must be aliens out there. Why can't it be some creature that evolved on Earth before we did? I mean, we know more about the moon than we do about the oceans.
Interesting points. Jill, any comment?
Well, the life that we know on Earth is fundamentally connected and related. We're all evolved from the same last common ancestor. There could be other life, this so-called weird life that's based on some other biology that we haven't yet detected, and it could very well predate the life that we're aware of. Or it could, in fact, be something that we can create in the laboratory in the future. So, yes, I think there is a lot to learn, and there's certainly technologies that we haven't yet invented which might be useful for interstellar communication. The only plan there is to stick around long enough to get smart enough to invent that technology and start using it.
Go ahead and finish.
Well, it may be that in some other advanced technology, it's the Institute for Ancient Instruments that's doing the transmitting for the purpose of the emergent technologies, the young folks such as us.
Here's an email from Randall in Cincinnati who says, what would be the protocol if indeed evidence was discovered of life or a signal of design? How would that be released to the public? What's your reaction, John?
Well, I'd say with respect to Kepler, which is not going to be detecting technology or civilizations directly, that we have a science team that vets the candidates for each planetary candidate. And after considering all the evidence, we release our findings. And you should look forward very much to early next year, because if Kepler works, it should find many, or at least several, giant planets in close in orbits, more similar to HAPP-7b. And so we want to be absolutely lock sure that, lock and barrel, that every one of our candidates that we release as a discovery is a bona fide planet. And it's going to be very difficult because we're searching for a golden needle in a haystack, much as Jill has with the SETI search. Not all the signatures that we see in our data are due to planets. Some of them are due to eclipsing binary stars or other astrophysical Keplerian clocks. So we have to be very careful. And as we push down to smaller and smaller planets, it gets harder and harder to directly confirm. And indeed, by the time we get to Earth-like planets in Earth-like orbits around Sun-like stars, there's no technology available to us today to directly confirm a discovery by Kepler. So we're bootstrapping our way to confidence and credibility, and that's our mission.
And here's an email from Scott in Cincinnati. How would we identify non-carbon-based life? And how do we define extraterrestrial life? Is it a single cell or a complex multi-cell organism? Jill?
Well, those are very complex questions. I actually have a pragmatic answer to the latter, and that's I define intelligent life as something that has the ability to build and operate a transmitter, because that's all I'll be able to find. With respect to the larger question of life, we do not have a good and inclusive working definition.
No.
We're at the point now where before we could define water as being H2O, we had lots of different definitions that didn't exactly do the job and didn't discriminate against some other colorless liquids. So it's very hard. And one of the ways that we could perhaps understand the limits of biology and the opportunities for life is to discover a different biology other than the one that evolved here on Earth.
Here's a very interesting email from Mary, who says, Bob Parks of the University of Maryland Physics Department summed it up well in his weekly email, What's New? Space travel. He says, they aren't coming here either. In my item about the Kepler telescope last week, I said, we will never travel to another star. Several readers protested. As one said, never is a long time. But it's also a long trip. I invite those who thought my comment should have been qualified to carry out a calculation my class of freshman physics majors does every year. Choose the nearest star, Decide how long you're willing to travel, how fast you'll need to go to get there in that time, and what you will have to take with you. Alan.
It's really sobering to realize that we can't even today build a spacecraft which travels anywhere as close to the speed of light. Our fastest spacecraft that are leaving the solar system, like the Voyagers and the New Horizons spacecraft, which is heading for Pluto, they're traveling at a speed where it takes them basically 10 years just to go out to the outer solar system. To get to the closest star, you're now talking about traveling for 100,000 years. Even if you improve our chemical propulsion systems by a factor of 10, you're down to 10,000 years. I don't think anyone wants to consider trying with human lifetimes and cryo-freezing and other Hollywood gimmicks to imagine sending such a spacecraft out, at least not with human beings. You might want to send a little robot out and then hope it comes sends you an email 10,000 years later, but that's about the best we can hope.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's take a caller in Jenison, Michigan. Good morning, Andre.
Good morning. My question is, does the speaker think that the planet Mercury was once a gas giant planet?
I think I can answer that. No, we believe that all of the interterrestrial planets formed by the same process, namely the banging together progressively larger and larger rocky bodies. The gas giant planets are pretty much limited to the outer solar system, in our case, and some of them may have been stripped down to become ice giants. The fact that we found these hot Jupiters around other stars implies that in some cases planets can migrate inwards. So you can take a Jupiter and form it out of normal Jupiter-like distance and have it migrate inwards, and sometimes it will lose some of its atmosphere, but basically even the hot Jupiters are pretty stable, so we do not think that a hot Jupiter will end up producing a Mercury.
Thanks for calling. And to Kurt in Salt Lake City. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
I just wanted to ask the city experts, how do you explain the thousands of eyewitnesses who see UFOs in the world every year, the government witnesses that talk about UFO government projects, and all the countless photographs and videos that are...
Sorry about that. Jill, do you want to comment?
Well, the yes, there is a lack of hard data in this field. Videos and photographs can be altered and photoshopped. I have not been given any data, although I do say, as a psychop fellow, that I am eager to see evidence that people wish to present for backing up their claims. Yes, people see unidentified phenomena, but we've got millions of years of evolution. That means that our brain tries to interpret what we see as something that we already know or believe in. And we don't actually do a good job of just seeing. We interpret. Yeah. And there are phenomena yet to be discovered. Sprites and elves, which are essentially lightning that goes upward from the tops of thunderclouds, were reported, eyewitness reports by high-flying pilots for years before we actually had satellites looking down with fast enough cameras to record these phenomena. They're real. They just have nothing to do with little green men or women or spacecraft. And so I think that's the link that's lacking. There's no evidence that links phenomena yet to be explained with spacecraft.
And yet, Alan, you've written a book titled The Crowded Universe. It's a very tantalizing title. Do you believe that ultimately we will find life as we know it in the universe?
I think there's a good chance we will do that, and the way to do it is through the SETI program that Jill and her colleagues are working on. That's the way, most efficient way to broadcast your existence to the galaxy is to send targeted messages to other stars that you think have a habitable planet or you know have a habitable planet. And so that's the best way for us to find out that someone else is out there.
Do you think it'll happen in your lifetime?
Well, I'm 58, so I would say probably not. But hopefully my children or grandchildren's lifetime, this will happen.
It would be very exciting if it did. We think, we don't know, Very, very interesting. Alan Bos, he is the author of The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. From Berkeley, Jill Tarter. She's director of the Center for SETI Research, and that's spelled SETI. And John Jenkins is the principal investigator for the SETI Institute at NASA Ames Research Center. Thank you all so much. And thanks for listening, all. Keep looking at the skies. I'll be back with you tomorrow. I'm Diane Rehm.